like I took a few pulls and I noticed that it was a little too hard and that Paul was starting to come off and some of these guys were starting to crack. And I was, and then like Valverde said, we need to like keep it together. So then like him and I seemed like we were doing the most work. But I think it was almost like the roadie mentality of like the group. Eventually we got told they were like 2.5-3 minutes up. And I think at that point they were like, okay, well it's gone. It was like, I was racing with the mentality of like, this is a gravel race. The odds of one of those guys crashing or flatting is very high. So it was like, we're not out of racing for the podium yet.
It's showtime, everybody. Showtime.
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show and welcome to an extra special recap episode. We got tons of requests for a UCI Gravel World Champs recap episode, which was encouraging. But to be honest, we always had it on the plan. I always knew this was going to be a really unique event, one that we wanted to report on a little bit and just share the experience of. Somewhat similar blueprint to the Grand Prix recap episodes we've done this year, but with some slight twists. We'll kick things off with a sound bite portion, kind of like we do with the Grand Prix episodes, but rather than being a cross section of all the different participants, regardless of ability level, sending us in their sound bites, it's just Team USA. So we got, I don't know, a good handful of reports from both men and women, and even Yuan, one of the USA Cycling mechanics. So that'll be a really fun section. But the meat of this episode is an interview with Keegan Swinson, who had an absolutely stellar ride, finishing fifth, really legitimizing his level, and to an extent, you know, the level that we're all aspiring to here in the States on the global stage, which was really cool. It was fun to be a part of. We'll talk about how much of a part of it we were able to actually be as a team. I also would have loved to have gotten a longer interview with Lauren Stevens, who was sixth in the women's race, but couldn't track her down in time. We'll hopefully do that in the near future. And then we wrap things up with a little Q&A section, a little bit old school. We haven't done a Q&A for quite a while, but there were a lot of questions sent in to the Adventure Stash Instagram. So thanks for that. And we get to a good handful of those. Firstly, I do want to say a big thank you to Zip for supporting today's episode. Really exciting news from Zip recently as they just launched the 1-0 High Top SW wheel, which is a wheel that I've actually been on for a year at this point. I rode it all the way across Tasmania as a prototype. I've been racing it all year in the Grand Prix, and I just absolutely love this wheel. One of the main differentiators is instead of just going after the all-out lightest, all-out stiffest wheel, it is light, it is stiff, but it has this vertical compliance that it seems like in the arms race of being lighter and stiffer, a lot of other wheels have kind of forgotten about. Just ride quality. And the ride quality of this wheel, sometimes I say it's almost a little bit springy. I like to say it feels alive, really, and that has a lot to do with the carbon layup, the shape of the rim. It borrows some from the 3-0 Moto wheels, the other Zip mountain bike wheels. And I just love it. I can't say enough. It has really killer hubs, the ZM2 SL hubs. This wheel also comes in a little bit more affordable option, the 1-0 High Top S. But you can find out everything you could possibly want to know at SRAM.com. I also want to say a big thank you to Salt Stick and their Go Fast Chews. I've been a big fan of these for quite a while. They would have been great in the World Championships race, honestly, because it was so hectic. It was so full on. I didn't have any with me, but these are chewable electrolyte tablets. They come in a handful of great flavors, including lemon lime, mixed berry, and tropical mango. And the key here is that a chewable like this can be 4 times faster in terms of making a difference in absorption of those electrolytes. Really good for super hot days when you just want to change it up instead of just trying to drink all your electrolytes, or when things are just action-packed, whether it be a single-track race, ride, or a hectic race. You can go to saltstick.com and get 20% off with code PAYSON20, or you can get them at REI, Amazon, etc. Highly recommend going and checking these out at saltstick.com, code PAYSON20 for 20% off. Okay, let's jump into this thing. First part, like I said, is the soundbite section. Kind of gave folks a little bit more freedom. Didn't cap everyone at 60 seconds this time just because I knew we'd have fewer submissions than is typical. But I hope you enjoy it. And I do want to say a big thank you to 1UP USA for supporting this, just like they support the soundbite section for our normal Grand Prix recaps. They're doing the same for the special Team USA edition. Big shout out to them for making the best bike racks in the biz. You can go to 1UP-USA.com to learn more about them. All right, let's get into this first section of soundbites with Team USA. Thanks for listening today.
My name's Zach Calton. I'm from Ogden, Utah, and I had a really good time at Gravel Worlds. The course was a lot more selective than I was expecting. I heard about last year's being somewhat of a glorified road race, so I expected there to be quite a bit of tactics and, pretty mundane course. And even after looking at the course file, I still expected that. But once we got there in person, it was super clear that it would not be very tactical. It would be full gas from the gun with early pinch points, really narrow roads, just really going to be tough to move up. And I think the top guys knew that. So as soon as we started, it was full gas, like unlike really any race I've ever done. It raced a lot more like a marathon mountain bike race than it did like an Unbound or Crusher or similar gravel race. I was really surprised the skill gap between riders. If I pushed it pretty hard, I could get a 10-15 second gap on like a 1 minute descent. I just think tire choice knowledge and the field being made up of a lot of true pure roadies in some of their first gravel races played into that. But yeah, bike handling was super important, and much more so than most American gravel racing. The fans were super cool. They weren't just at the start and finish, but every steep climb was just full of people with chainsaws, cowbells, screaming their heads off. The fan support was really awesome. They were super welcoming to me, like being from the U.S. I felt like even in a group of five or more countries, the fans singled out me in the U.S. kit, which was pretty cool. I'm not sure if that's because it was gravel or just because, we're in Europe and it's rare to see people from over the pond, but the fans were really supportive, and that was awesome. And then just as far as like being involved with the UCI, people start taking it more seriously, you don't know what the vibe was going to be like, but I will say my competitors were super nice and positive and raced really clean. Everyone's obviously trying their hardest, but the camaraderie and like, as you pass people, they give you a good job, mate. Like it was really positive and a good experience with my competitors too. So yeah, definitely had a good time.
Hi, this is Paige Onwaller, and I am from Michigan, just returning back from the UCI Gravel World Championships over in Italy. And I just wanted to mention just a few tidbits of experiences that I had. First was just the uniqueness of the course and how the roads are structured there. Very tight and narrow and kind of what we would describe as European style. And this was something that we just don't get to experience back home in the US very much. Navigating through vineyards and just tight alleys and turns, and just the amount of people that were lining the course to me was incredible. And this was not an easy spectating course. This was like a 90-mile course that didn't really have a lot of loops or double backs, but there was still a plethora of people in various locations, particularly on the climbs. And that was just really fun to experience, especially since back home we're often racing and we're kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and not a lot of people line the course like that. So that was a really cool experience, and definitely enjoyed some European or Italian pushes up some of those hills. So if you know what I'm talking about, then you know. The other thing that I'll mention is just the lack of women's coverage, which I'm sure many people are already made aware of. This was really disappointing and frustrating for me. I was also just blown away by the response of the European road riders, that many of them seemed unfazed or kind of that this was expected. And from us in the US, I think we're used to the equity that we have over here. And it just really was eye-opening to me, really. And I think it made me appreciate how things are structured back home. And there's pain points for this discipline as it grows and as things change. But this was something that I definitely don't want to take for granted, that we do have a lot of equal coverage and equal payout here in the US. Doesn't mean that my frustration that the coverage or the lack of coverage didn't anger me, but it definitely put things in perspective and made me realize the differences that may occur in other nations. Still a lot of work to be done in that area. Yeah, I mean, there's so much more I could say, but overall the experience was positive. And I went over there for learning, which many of us, you know, really didn't have this race as a priority because we didn't even know if we'd qualify until like 2 weeks before. So it's kind of chaos just getting there. But I'm happy that I prioritized the learning and the opportunity to go over there and help out some of the riders that made this a priority event for the year.
Hey, Payson, this is Justin McQuarrie from Austin, Texas. Can't comment on much of the UCI Gravel World Championships, as my race ended pretty early on. What I thought were pre-race nerves ended up being some actual sickness and just wasn't meant to be for me. I can comment on the hectic start we had, cyclocross course to start, followed by a short road section and then super dusty gravel, all at proper pro road race speeds, was absolutely wild. Couldn't see more than a bike length ahead as soon as the dust kicked up, and it was very exciting to see gravel reach such a high level of competition. USA guys seemed to be punching at the front from the very beginning, cementing the fact that we were there to fight for it. I wish things were a bit different for me and I would have been able to contribute to the team effort, but it's a fair bit of motivation to get some redemption in the coming season. Thanks, Payson. Catch you the next one.
Hi, here Joan, mechanic from USA Cycling. My best experience from the Gravel Worlds was share time with all the riders, staff, and keep working very, very hard for do the best as we can do. Very good memories.
I'm David Van Orsdell, originally from Minneapolis, but I live in Lucca, Italy, where I race on and manage a gravel team called Reverb Cycling. At the World Championships, it was a pretty typical European gravel race of very chaotic at the start, narrow roads with a lot of turns, something that over here we're pretty used to. It's really, really full gas at the start and chaotic. I was able to work my way to the front. Unfortunately, wasn't able to connect with Keegan to help out at all, as was the plan. And then after, as the race just continued to explode, everybody just, you know, you kind of need to just push on as you're able and to do. But I think the rest of the team is really feeling positive about what we could accomplish in the future. I think if we're able to get more guys coming over here to do some of the UCI gravel races and get used to the style of racing, I think that we have a really good shot at making another concerted bid at a rainbow jersey as a nation, as a team.
My name is Brennan Wirtz, and I am from Marin County, California. I think the thing for me that stood out the most at the recent Gravel World Championships had to have been the massive amounts of fans on the side of the road lining the course pretty much from start to finish. I think usually when we're racing in the U.S., our races are a bit more remote than the course was for the World Championships, and yeah, just a bit harder to get to, and also maybe less fans in general, but it was super, super cool to see how many Italian fans there were along the course in every little town and on all the steep climbs cheering. It was at certain points almost deafening, the noise and the cheering of the fans. So that was a super cool experience. And even though I was properly suffering on some of those final climbs, the loud noise and the very enthusiastic fans made it still such a great experience and really a nice way to finish off the race. So I think for me, that was a real highlight and something cool that was definitely different than the racing that I'm used to doing back home.
Hey, Payson. Lexi McMillan here, also known as Willie's dad. I was very unsure what to expect heading into Gravel Worlds. Being a part of the growth of gravel in the U.S. sometimes feels like an absolutely separate world from how gravel is growing as a discipline all around. And I think I had these expectations that gravel world championships would feel a lot like what I'd done on the road. And I can honestly say it wasn't. I think what the UCI did really well was, first off, create an incredible course that had a true gravel winner at the end, in my opinion, but also leave space for everybody to race. I really expected us to go there and all experience it and think, wow, we have something cool going on in the U.S. I'm just going to go keep racing in the U.S. But I honestly left Italy thinking, where else can I put these races? Do they fit into the Grand Prix next year? The race was incredible. It was gnarly. And I just can't wait to go back.
Okay. Back in Bentonville. Been about a year since we were here last. Year since you were here last.
Yeah.
Doubleheader this time, though. Like a lot of us, you're finishing out your year with a lot of races in a row. We'll talk about Worlds in a minute. But one thing I was thinking about is, so you have the Grand Prix locked up, obviously. There's no payout at Big Sugar, right?
No, not that I know of.
But you have to show up and at least start.
Yeah.
But before we started recording, you said you're looking forward to it, maybe even more so than Little Sugar, the mountain bike race the weekend before. So what are you riding for? Like, why are you excited?
I like the way Big Sugar races. I think I had a lot of fun racing here last year. Like, the course is fast. It's, but not too fast. Like, it's kind of technical in its own weird way. Like, it's nothing really that challenging, but the surface is loose and there's like, a bunch of like rocks and ruts and some steep climbs. And I think the race, it favors aggressive racing. Like, you can sit in a little bit, but only so much, you know?
Yeah. Super punchy.
I also like racing when it's fun racing under pressure, but it's also more fun to race when you have nothing to lose. Yeah. Like, you can just race however you want and, you know, you just race with reckless abandon.
Yeah.
So I think I'm excited for that, you know, and it's also just like the last race of the year. It's just like no pressure. Just go out and race and have fun. I mean, a lot of different position for you guys who have to fight for every spot still.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, so it's, I don't know. It's fun. You know, I'm looking forward to it. So
even though there's no, cause I assume you're capped on bonuses for the year too.
Yeah.
So from a professional standpoint, you literally have nothing to ride for.
Yeah, it's just a bike race for me. You know, it's just to go out and have a good time. And yeah. In the end, I love, obviously there's other motivators like money, bonuses, like winning the overall and so on. But sometimes it's nice to just go out and just race hard, you know, and have a good time. And I think sometimes, you know, Sophia and I are talking about that. Like, she just wants to like go out and have a good time and chat with people and roll across the start line. Whereas like, I want to go out and race full gas and, you know, race. There's like nothing to lose. I can race like an idiot and, you know, whatever happens, happens. Yeah. So. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. I mean, I want to have her on soon because I am really curious about that, perspective, like her just like not really having motivation for it. Cause I feel like most bike racers would probably feel more the way you do because the sport's so hard that you just have to love going hard and going for it. But I'll be really curious to hear from her, like, because I think sometimes your motivations are a bit different.
Yeah, and maybe it's more of like a men versus women thing too. Like, we just like to go out and like just ego, you know? Like, we just like to go out and kill each other. So maybe that could be a small part of it. I don't know. I'm sure there's women that also feel that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe they're more cordial. Because for us, like, we don't know. You'd like to go out and just hammer, and it's like a group ride, you know? You just go out and rip.
100%. Okay, so world champs. You mentioned a minute ago you're still feeling kind of beat up. I assume some of that is just literally from hitting the ground, but also is a super hard race, hard course. At what point in the year did this go on your schedule, like officially?
It had been on the schedule since the beginning of the year. Honestly, I was a little bit bummed I didn't go last year, just with Road Worlds and, you know, the Grand Prix, and there was just a lot going on. And like, I was, in the end, it was the right decision not to go, but I was still a little bummed I missed out. I definitely had some FOMO, you know? I was like, oh, I wish I had done that. It looked like, I mean, obviously the course didn't look like it was quite as great as this year. But yeah, so it was on the schedule at the beginning of the year, but I didn't really like, you know, zero in on focus on into it until we like got the course. And really after Leadville, this was the next next big goal.
So, yeah, big key. Yeah. So in terms of prep, like obviously preparation for going after the Leadville record, average elevation, 10,000 feet, hour long climb, like that's going to look really different than the world's gravel course. Mm-hmm. One thing that, I mean, you're someone that likes to prepare super specifically for these goals, obviously, but we didn't even know the world's course until, was it like 3 weeks out? Yeah, I think it sort of like started to trickle out. Maybe
there's like some rumors.
GPX files, but I think the first GPX file I saw was like listed as a running route. And I was like, right. I don't know how much this could be trusted. At what point did you and Jim, your coach, like, did you start zooming in on, okay, this could be a key climb. This is how the race might play out. And what did that look like training wise?
Yeah, I mean, you know, going to Leadville, you know, like you mentioned, we have all the altitude prep and the big volume and you're prepping for the hour-long climbs and so on. So I think there's at a really good base going into this. So it was really just kind of tuning the motor a little bit. You know, we didn't have the course exactly and didn't know the profile and so on. But in the end, we kind of knew it was going to be a lot more aggressive. We knew it wasn't going to be as long, like probably close to 5 hours. So kind of started training that system a little more, working on the VO2, a little more threshold. Because these other, going into Leadville and whatnot, it was more just sweet spot and, you know how it goes, like
diesel bigger stuff.
Diesel stuff. Yeah. So we started tuning that and a little more intensity. Yep. And as we got closer and we kind of realized what the course was going to be, we, you know, focused even more on VO2 and worked on that stuff and kind of trained through gravel gnats and Schwamigan and all those kind of worked quite well to prep for this. So, did the best we could with the knowledge we had. I mean, everyone's in the same boat, you know, came out so late. So you only had so much info, but, given the amount of time we had from Leadville, it was like only so much we can do anyway. Did a good job and just, tried to dial in the intensity a bit. Cause obviously this course is so different than what we're used to. You know, it's like a lot of the races over here, it's more like long and those power is a little smoother. And like you're dictating, like us at the front are dictating the pace a little more. Whereas over there, you're just at the mercy of what's going to happen. And I learned that at Road Worlds last year, you know, I think like just when it's on, it's really on. And this race was on the entire time.
Yeah.
I kind of mentioned to Betsy after the race, it's like, it seemed like a mix of Road Worlds and Cape Epic, like in the sense of like Cape, it seemed like the first 30 minutes of Cape Epic, but all day long.
Yeah.
Because Epic has vineyards and you're racing on these two track roads. And it's like, sometimes there's some open gravel roads. So it's like kind of a similar vibe to, except there's even, there's a lot more racers at Gravel Worlds. And it was a little more intense, but, it was kind of a similar vibe to that. It was like mixing those two together. So I felt like those two prepared me well for it. Cause I definitely learned a lot at Worlds last year, Road Worlds. That is like, these guys, everything's just so cutthroat racing.
It really is.
You know?
Yeah. I've posted those couple of videos from the start and so many people are just like, how is this allowed? I'm like, you have no idea. This is so normal.
And then like you throw everyone on gravel tires and all of a sudden like, you don't have to stay on the roads anymore. Like, I'm just going straight to the apex, you know? So sometimes like you'd be the first one to do a move like that. And you look like seeing your videos like, oh wow, everyone did that.
Yeah.
Like one of those turns I knew I was the first one to cut and I went straight to the front and then like, oh, then you saw everyone was doing that same line.
Serious so trendsetter.
kind of crazy, you know, you're like, oh, now you give these guys a little bit of like a little tread and bigger tires that aren't just going to flat the second you go off the pavement. And then it's just all open. If there's not tape there, it's just the way it is.
Yeah. At what point did you hear what the start protocol was going to be? Did you hear any rumors about like whether, cause I think a lot of people are like, how do you not count, you know, results from the biggest gravel races ever? But I kind of get why the UCI didn't, because of just like their legacy of them caring about anything that's not UCI, but also like, how would you quantify that? Like if you're taking UCI points from all these other races, how do you decide how a first place at Unbound matches up against, you know, Wout's like second at Flanders or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, it's apples to oranges,
exactly.
You know, like I was prepared to not have to be just completely hosed and start in the back. So Like I knew, I had a feeling like last year, I knew they gave Ivar a call up from winning Unbound. So, but I was like, I think it was the first year and they had no, like there wasn't, they didn't have their series, they didn't have anything going on. So I figured that was like a one-time deal. And everyone's like, oh, like Ivar got a call up, you're going to get one. I'm like, no, I'm probably not. I think I'm going to be in trouble, you know? Like, so I mean, I was prepared to not have a good call up. I also didn't do any gravel series races. Yeah. I did expect to get points from nationals. That was also like, I mean, prize that money sucks. Aside and like wanted to do the first big first gravel nats. Like I was like, oh, it also would be good to go do it since I didn't do any of these UCI races. Like maybe we'll get some points. So I kind of figured that even, and then I was like, oh, then I learned it wasn't UCI, but I still kind of figured that they'd still throw us a bone and be like, oh, maybe the national champ will at least get a half decent call up.
Totally.
And then that wasn't the case. And I was like, well, at least they did Cape Epic and I did one XCO this year. So I had some UCI points. So I wasn't totally screwed.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not right the way they do it.
Yeah.
Because the roadies have so many points. Like
exactly. Yeah.
Like, Wout would have 6,000 points and Nino has 3,000. Like, so it's like completely different. And sure, you take half of the points, but then you cut everything. Like, it's just like,
how many points does Wout have?
I bet he has like 6,000 points.
So double what Nino has. Because of the number of races.
Yeah, they just race so much. Maybe it's 5,000, but I know like most of the time the top XCO athletes have like right around 3,000.
And so
the
road, that's kind of crazy right there because Nino probably would have been like third, fourth row.
Maybe? Right. Yeah, whereas he should be front row.
For sure.
Right? Interesting. And although I'm sure they would have thrown Nino a bone and give him a front row call because he's Nino. But they really should just do gravel points and then after that, they could start doing other points. Like anyone who did one of their Gravel World Series races should have had a call up near the front, and then they can stage road and mountain points behind them. You know, that's in my opinion, the way it should be.
Yeah.
But,
interesting. Yeah. Cause I heard, I don't know if you heard this too, but I heard rumor that the other national champs had UCI points, like British national championships had UCI points, Dutch, and we didn't because USAC put the money they would have had to give to the UCI to inscript it towards the prize purse is what I heard.
I don't think that would be true. Like this seems like, I bet someone, there was just some weird miscommunication because it was like, I mean, this whole gravel thing is the gravel point thing is so new.
Yeah.
And it's only those gravel world series races that have points. So I feel like they would have had to like make their race a gravel world series national.
Yeah,
so
that makes sense. Super convoluted.
Because the prize money at nationals like didn't come from USAC, so I don't know. I don't know.
It came from the town. Anyway,
So you ended up getting called up like 90th of 230. Is that right?
Yeah, it was 90th.
So could have been way better. Definitely could have been way worse. And then Luke was near you in like the 70s.
Yeah, he was actually directly ahead of me. Okay. We lined up both on the fence on the right, and he happened to be just one row ahead.
Yep.
Which worked out quite well.
So you guys got to the front. Actually, so there was a 3K-ish or 4K start loop, and then we went back through the start line, circuit style, and there's a photo of you and Luke like sitting third and fourth wheel or something already.
Yeah.
Where on that start loop did you make up most of the spots?
Probably, I had a couple of good lines, like two. I made it to the front before the end of the lake, like maybe a K and a half, 2K in.
Wow.
I made it to like fifth wheel.
Before the hairpin or before the far side of the lake?
Before the far side of the lake.
Damn. Crazy. So, was that like sneaky lines or were you straight up sprinting around the outside?
Bit of both. There's one point where I, you know, a couple sneaky lines, but then there's also one where there was before, like, you know, the end of the lake, there's that little descent before getting down, before making the U-turn to get on the pavement.
Yeah.
And everyone was riding on the asphalt and I just went in the gutter and the dirt and just like rolled through. And cause I figured this might be the only time.
So like you said earlier, when we're talking about the videos where you were like, I was the first to cut the corners on the road sections after. We were getting fully hosed on all those cutty lines on the start loop because you were the one taking them. The rest of us were like, this is our secret line coming up. And then just everyone took it.
Once someone does it, they all start doing it, you know? And I think I was if I was far enough up that all these other guys were kind of content where they were and they weren't willing to risk it. And I was like, I have to get to the very front because I don't want to be back here.
That's funny.
So I definitely found some holes. And I think, you know, I've raced enough XCO starting 80th, 90th to know, like, you kind of learn all these little tricks and know how to like move up without using a ton of energy. Yeah. And then, Luke and I, he found his way to the front pretty quick as well. And then we were able to kind of use each other a bit, which was helpful. And
That's cool.
Stay up there. But
one of the one ways we were, or that was like one of the only, kind of the only time that the team was actually able to help you probably. Although Alexi's proud of his little motivational,
yeah,
whatever.
The top. I was impressed he made it up there because I kept looking back and I'm like, I don't see anyone in a USA kit.
Dude, it was amazing. Because, I mean,
he must have ripped that climb.
Yeah. So basically, like, there was that dirt, the first kind of sustained climb, the climb to the castle,
mm-hmm.
like right. So there was the aid station right before it. And that aid station was it was like gaps through the aid station for us. And I was on Alexis Williams, like, you ready? And it was hilarious. I have the video of it. He starts sprinting around the outside, like all out sprint for 20 seconds. And I think we made two spots.
Yeah.
And I was just like, fuck.
You're like, wasn't worth it.
And then we settle in for a second. And then we start the climb and he looks back again and says, you ready again? And I was like, I don't know. Like, that was pretty hard. And somehow he went around the outside that time and made up a ton of spots. And then it split on that climb. So he made that front split and just like that second, the ability to go again, like that's what made it. So he got in the lead group and I was right there. And if I had the legs, I would have been in the same position. Did not have the legs.
And that was it.
That was
it. That group went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so moving on a little bit. One thing I was really curious about, I haven't published this video either, but I'm going to soon. The number of gaps that were opening on that long straightaway before the section I just described. So we go through that single track and then it was just really fast, mm-hmm. kind of straight. And the bit before the, like past the, like the gravel factory thing right before the single track.
Remember that? Yeah.
We went under those two overpass bridges. This is at like 30 minutes in maybe.
This is probably about 20K.
Yeah. 20K in.
Yeah.
And it was exploding. Like the gaps that were opening were just crazy. And so over and over, we were just doing like these 20 second all out efforts to bridge up on the front. From the photos I've seen, it seemed like you guys were riding steady, but like it was pretty fanned out some of the time. So what was it like maintaining position up there? Cause you're up there with, wow, a bunch of the Dutch guys. I think Jasper was up there. Paul Voss, Valverde eventually got up there. What was it like in that front pod? Like, did it feel like you were able to kind of conserve energy a bit, or were you on the gas knowing that everyone else behind was just like,
I think it fighting? Was a little bit of both. Like the guys were definitely pushing. Like it wasn't easy to sit up there, but it was definitely easier than being back where you guys were closing gaps and stuff. Cause I think everyone, like we had a decent little group there and it was really just fighting for position, like trying, cause no one really wanted to take wind, but it was like, everyone was willing to take a little bit to keep the pace up. It was kind of this weird dynamic of like, it was like a mini, like a little mini washing machine effect of the front group.
There's like 10 of y'all that it seemed like we're kind of doing.
Yeah.
That.
Everyone was kind of rolling through. Cause I think everyone knew like it had to, if it like kept it fast enough, then it wouldn't get like totally swarmed again.
Yep.
So it was kind of a weird dynamic there for a bit, but just try to do it. Like you wanted to like, and you didn't want to drift too far back because it was a little bit hectic in there. There was still a lot of those rocks that were flying around. Yeah. It was getting dusty. And if you got too far to the side of the road, there was like, it got loose, you know, and there was like tree branches and stuff. So it was a little dicey in there, but the pace definitely was more consistent, it sounds like, than it was for you guys.
Where did it feel like the front group solidified and you're like, okay, this is the first selection has happened and we're just going to like maintain, or did it stay pretty?
Honestly, I didn't really know what was going on behind. I was like more concerned about just like staying where I was. Like I would glance back every now and then to see like how big the group was, and it's still like big enough that I was like, this is still a really big group. Like it doesn't feel like anything's really happened. Like I'm sure we've lost some, but it still seemed like quite large. It wasn't really until like the second big climb, like about 55-60K in, that was like, okay, this is probably like the group after this is probably only gonna be about 40 guys.
After, like, this is after the first time through the finish line, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So after that, it's sort of like it was gravel, double track for a minute, and then it's kind of paved climb. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I look back and like I could see the end of the group this time. I was like, okay, that's probably the end of this group. It still like was big enough. I didn't want to ever be in the very back though.
Yeah.
You know, like it wasn't like selective enough that like, okay, now I can chill.
Mm-hmm.
It was still like you want to be fighting for position and still stay in the front. Cause we did that climb and then you descend. And I actually led that descent and then led that next climb.
Yeah.
Cause I wanted to lead the really kind of sketchy paved descent into that next valley we went into.
Yeah. That was a sketchy descent.
Yeah. And
two guys in front of me blew that turn and ended up in the vineyard.
Yeah. Like I wanted to lead that and push it fast and just keep it strung out as well. And then I wanted to lead that next little gravel sector.
Yeah.
Cause I found it was sometimes those places for me, it's like easier just to ride the front and I can just get a little time out of the corner. And then like, if you ride a reasonable tempo pace, like no one's going to come around and no one's going to attack. So for just sure. Find that balance.
For sure. Did you know that Wout had flatted and was out of the group?
Mm-hmm. I saw him flat before the first feed zone.
So you were, he was in front of you when he
yeah.
flatted.
Yeah, I actually saw his tire was going flat. And then Luke actually mentioned, hey, like Wout flatted. I saw him pull over in the feed zone. And then he came back. So you got that wheel change before the castle. That feed zone was, what, maybe 30K in that feed zone. So he fixed it. He got a new wheel there. And then I saw him flat again after the lake.
Interesting.
I could go around that lake, and then I saw him off to the side messing with his wheel.
Huh.
Because that's after I crashed, he'd passed me again. And then we'd pass that feed zone. And I was quite a ways back there. And then I passed him as he was back fussing with his wheel off the side of the trail.
Yep. So did Luke come off that group before Alexi joined the group, or how did that work? Or were they both in the group for a minute?
Don't know. I never saw Luke. I never really saw him again after the castle climb. I think he was still there, but I don't think he was in the front of that. Because the castle climb was pretty hard.
It deceptively hard.
Yeah.
It was like a weird false flat with a couple steep pitches.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think he was still there, but I don't know. I didn't really see him again. But yeah. it was pretty hectic. So yeah.
And then so one thing that I thought was pretty funny that Alexa told me is he made it onto that group, tacked onto the group, like went up, told you he was there.
Yeah.
And apparently
we checked in with each other quickly.
Yeah. And then apparently right after that, like you went to the front and just started pacing the group on the climb, kind of like you were saying where you wanted to lead into the descent. And he immediately got blown off the back of the group. And he was like, son of a bitch, you have no idea how hard I worked to get up here. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. I didn't, in hindsight, like, but I think in the end of that next climb, it was so short. I was like, man, if I don't do this, someone else is going to do it. And they might make it even harder than I was going to do. Yeah. Like I rode hard, but I didn't attack it, you know? And I didn't want like someone else to come over the top of me at like 700 watts. And I was like, if I go hard enough, like it'll just string out. And I didn't think about like, I was like, oh, Alex, if he made it up here, he'll make it up that one, you know?
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing too, where I think like road racing tactics and gravel tactics definitely differed, because Alexi also said that there were some guys in the group, like a few of the World Tour guys, were kind of like chuckling about the fact that you were riding on the front, like showing your hand a little bit, like I'm here, I'm strong. And so they immediately were going to mark you. And like, in a way you'd handed away that advantage of surprise for anyone that was underestimating you. But what they're not thinking about is the advantage, like how big of an advantage it is in gravel racing to lead through certain sections. And it sounds like through that crazy paved descent, and then it was like weird, flat, slippery gravel right after that. And then the loop around the lake was super narrow and slippery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it just blew apart there. Like I'm sure your group went from 20 to what was it, like 7?
Yeah, that's exactly where it blew up. You know, and I think it's a balance of like, man, I knew I was like, I might show them a little more than I wanted to. But I thought it was worth being able to lead there.
Yeah.
And I also thought maybe he's strong now, but he'll just blow up, you know? I thought maybe that would work. Like, he's just some stupid American. He's just going too hard right now. So I thought that was also, I was like, maybe it'll work out just fine, you know? And I was, you know, I led that whole section down below after that climb. And then I had a little, like, I just slid out and like messed up a corner. And then I was like, fell back to fifth or sixth, whatever. And then that's when I crashed. Before that feed zone.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, then it got really strung out, because that was right before it pinched again, before going around the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I was chasing. I was like, man, this is really hard to chase.
Yeah.
Like I'm not making much time. I'm going quite hard to like bring them back.
Yeah.
So that's when the race really separated. Cause then when I was going around the lake, I had picked off a few guys here and there. Then I eventually got to like the third group, and then rode up to the second group after that climb. And then eventually caught like Valverde.
Yep.
And I think Paul
was in there,
and there was an Italian. Maybe the Italian came with me. I don't know, but I was riding kind of out of my skin for like 30 minutes. Cause I was like, I need to at least get to the second group.
Yeah.
And then once I saw Valverde, then I saw that the first group was only 20 seconds up.
Like, yeah.
This is a good place to be. You know?
Yeah. So it ended up being that those groups kind of solidified. One thing I'm curious about though, we can talk about the Valverde battle, but what did you, riding with these guys, did you pick up on anything? Like, did you learn anything about the way they race or different strengths and weaknesses? Like, obviously they're crazy strong. Like the thing Dennis always tells me is like, just if they need to, the amount of power that they can put out is just crazy. Like doing all these super long races, especially at altitude. Like I think obviously, especially you, but all of us, like our aerobic engines get pretty good. But sometimes like that super explosive power that they need for a lot of the road races they do, like that's definitely a major edge they have. Did you notice that at all? Did you feel like, did you come away thinking like, I want to work on this, or seems like we have an edge here coming from our scene, anything like that?
It's funny. I think this race was hard enough from the beginning and it was like very sustainable. Like it was hard the whole time and it was, all the climbs were intense. Like that castle climb was wide open. Then the climb at like 55, 60K was pretty pinned. Like I was riding well over threshold up that one.
Yep.
And I think, so I think that, and then even when you were in the bunch, you're still riding quite hard. So I don't think that they had that like same anaerobic hit. Because once I caught that Valverde group, like those guys were all pretty toast.
Yeah.
Like I took a few pulls and I noticed that it was like, it was a little too hard and that Paul was starting to come off and some of these guys were starting to crack. And I was, and then like Valverde said, we need to like keep it together. So and then like him and I seemed like we were doing the most work.
Yeah.
And then there was that, the Poggio climb.
The super steep
short. Yeah. And that one I rode very hard because those guys were 20 seconds up. And I was like, this is kind of the last place where we can really like pull time on them before we drop over the back.
Yeah.
And at the top of the climb, Valverde and I had a small gap, like separation. And I don't know, like I was pretty boxed. And I think he was kind of on the limit as well. And like we chased for a bit and those other guys, Paul and whoever else was there, I think maybe the Italian guy, like, I don't know if they couldn't or they didn't want to, or they were thinking we would, but it seemed like everyone kind of lost motivation to chase.
Interesting.
And we pushed hard for a while. Like we were pulling quite hard, you know, but then once that group like got out of sight, those guys really lost motivation. And I think like Valverde was always pulling quite hard. And then we eventually got caught by Quinton Hermans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an Austrian guy that came with. So those guys actually started working quite hard as well. But I think it was almost like the roadie mentality of like the group. Eventually we got told they were like 2.5-3 minutes up. And I think at that point they were like, okay, well it's gone. It was like, I was racing with the mentality of like, oh, like this is a gravel race. The odds of one of those guys crashing or flatting is very high. So it was like, we're not out of racing for the podium yet. Like in my mind,
what's crazy is Mohoric did crash.
Right.
Vermeers dropped his chain.
Like, yes, all it would have taken is worse mechanicals, right?
Exactly.
And that's why I think like we just kept pushing. Like we could have gotten close because Connor Swift,
yeah.
Is that his name? Yeah. So he was only 3 minutes up at the end, whereas the other guys were like six.
Yeah.
So like he cracked.
He cracked and hard. Like, oh, There's a video of him just dropping.
Yeah, like if he would have like cracked harder or had a mechanical as well, like the race for the podium, like, I was like, for sure the win is gone. Like one of these guys will make it. But it doesn't mean the medals are gone.
Yeah.
So I think I was riding quite hard until then. And then back to your point of these guys having the anaerobic power, like Valverde did kick pretty hard over that that first gnarly climb, like at the end of the circuit, the second circuit, the one
through the vineyard?
Yeah, the vineyard. You did an opener over the top of it.
The short one.
Yeah. Like that one was, like I couldn't push on the pedals any harder over the top of that climb, you know?
Which is crazy because he's what, 43? Like usually that sort of thing starts to slip.
Like, and that was where like him, the Belgian, and I were the only ones to make it over that climb. Mm-hmm. And then I put a dig in through the creek crossings.
Mm-hmm.
And then, there was just the three of us the rest of the way. And then it was like the next two climbs were quite interesting. Like, cause I noticed when Valverde was leading, it was a little more surgy and I didn't really like that. So I just set a pace that I thought was hard enough that they wouldn't be like
coming around you.
They were enticed to attack, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like, I know I can ride like 400 plus right now, but I can't do anything more. Like I can't attack right now.
Yeah.
So if I do this, then it'll be okay.
Yeah.
You know? And it worked out all right. Like no one did anything. I think everyone was pretty done and it was just going to wait to the last climb at that point.
Yeah.
Cause Valverde had tried to attack a little bit and we were able to ride back to him. So.
Yeah. And it looked like on the last climb, I don't know at what point on the climb it was, but he had a bit of a gap on you.
Yeah.
How did he get that gap?
So he attacked on the very last climb. He attacked kind of near the bottom. I was starting to cramp like on the, actually there's that hair, there's a very hard, like hard right-hand hairpin and it just slowly
falls
picks
flat
up before you actually start climbing.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to cramp there. and started, you know, I was a little worried. Like, oh, this is going to be a rough climb if I'm already cramping.
So torquey.
Yeah. So he attacked at the bottom and I didn't really respond. I picked up the pace and just rode the pace that I knew I could ride. And then I just brought it up to like, I just held it like 12 seconds or whatever it was. And a gap that I knew I could close in the descent. I was like, if I just keep him within sight and make sure he saw that he wasn't pulling on me. Yep. So then he stopped pushing as well. And he just held that same gap. And then I was able to close in the descent.
Yep.
So.
And then in the sprint, it was this kind of long, like sweeping left. And I went back and watched it. And it looks like you guys waited pretty good while. Like it was a fairly short sprint.
And because I had actually attacked it. I passed him. So after the climb, you kind of traverse and you climb again. Then you do the road descent. And then there's that.
Sketch road descent.
The sketch road descent. So I led that. And then you drop into that sketchy alley. There's an alley descent.
Super down weird. These cobbles. Yeah.
And I attacked down that. And I actually came out with like maybe 8 seconds.
Damn, yeah.
And then I got back on the gas and was just going flat out. So he was...
Narrow bike path with like railings.
And he wasn't... So sketchy. Because he wasn't on the wheel. But he eventually came back with like... He caught me with like 2.5K to go.
Yeah.
And then... So he was worked from bridging and I was worked from trying to attack him.
Yeah.
And then I blew a corner, which worked out because he passed me and he had the lead.
Yeah.
And then, going into that sprint, like I knew I wanted to be first into that corner. And I just like kind of snuck up on me.
Yeah.
Like I was, and he was paying a lot of attention. Like I was about to kick and go.
He was looking back the whole time.
Oh yeah. And he like saw me twitch to attack and then he launched his sprint and then I just got on the wheel and I mean, there wasn't much time to come around and he covered the inside of both corners as I expected him to. So I was going to go on the left and then he was there. I had to go right, which was longer. So
yeah.
Yeah.
What did he say to you at the finish? He doesn't have much English, but did he say anything at the finish?
No. I mean, we just talked a little bit. I think he was like, he was stoked on the battle, you know?
That's cool.
So even
that's going... That's the sense I get is he still loves racing.
Just loves like fighting, you know, going into that last climb. Like you could tell he was stoked. Like he like looked at me a few times and he's like, you could tell the Belgian was pretty smoked, but he knew that I still had a little bit of fight left. So
nice.
Yeah, it was a good time.
That's cool. All right. This is going way longer than I said. We need to get you out of here, but, moving forward, I mean, I have to assume you shared some of the same feelings I did, which it was just so cool to feel like you were in the major leagues of European bike racing again. And I know like it wasn't a World Cup field, it wasn't a World Tour field, but just in terms of the energy, like the climbs were four people deep at some points. Yeah. Like I haven't done a European World Cup for a long time, but it all came back. Like it's different over there. So you have an amazing thing going over here in the States, obviously. I know you love this style racing, love Leadville, all those races. What are you thinking moving forward? Like, do you want to do some of the Grand Gravel Series races? Does this feel like it's a new door opening? Or do you think it'll continue to be like, oh, I'm just going to drop into Worlds each year and see what happens?
Yeah, it's funny. I've kind of thought about that as well. I think... I mean, I'll continue doing kind of what we're doing over here and would like to try and mix in a little bit more of the European stuff and just kind of do the ones that I think interest me or that look like they might be a good time and maybe go over and just to try and get, maybe combine it with like a marathon mountain bike race. Like do one weekend, do 2 weekends over there or something. Cause I do appreciate the style of racing. I mean, you can't beat it. Like racing in Europe, it's just cutthroat and it's just so aggressive. And then like you mentioned the fans, like especially racing in Italy, like it was incredible, you know, like
crazy.
Like there's just people deep all the way up the climbs and they're like moving as you ride through.
Yeah.
And you don't get that experience anywhere else. Cause even racing World Cups, it's like the course is taped. So they're only so deep, you know, I think you only get that interaction with the spectators and the fans, like when you're racing on the roads.
Yeah.
It was cool. And I think it's a different format of gravel racing. Like, you know, over here, some people might not consider it like quote gravel, but it's just different. And they don't have the same kind of terrain we do. So you have to work with what they have, you know, like they can't go and do a 200 mile race on only gravel and turn every 20 miles. Right.
Yeah.
Like, so you have to you're just racing through vineyards and your little two tracks and maybe somewhere in Spain, there's places where you can do like more wide open, like American style racing.
Yeah.
I do wish or hope that the race gets longer in the future. I think 5 hours is a little short. you know, like I went to Row Worlds last year and that was like 280K or 260. Yeah, like huge. It was like 6.5 hours.
Yeah.
Like I think arguably gravel should be the same or longer. Mm-hmm. So it'd be cool to have a 6 to 7 hour event. I think it really changes the race.
Totally.
Cause I think the start would be, it would be just as intense, but then it would just be more of a game of survival.
Yeah.
In the
people
end.
Would die. People were already dying. Like the number of people I was right. I think I rode through 30 riders in the last two climbs. Like people were absolutely on their hands smoked, and knees. You know?
So I think it'd be cool to make it longer. Cause it would like, just make it more like a proper gravel racing over here. Like even if you change like the courses are changed, whatever, that's fine. But I think the distance and the time racing should be like closer to what we normally do.
Yeah, I agree.
Because even for the World Tour guys too, they're always racing. Like all the classics are 6+ hours. Like
for sure.
World Championships are always almost 300K. Yeah. So,
It'll be interesting to see how it develops.
But.
Yeah. And it is true. It's a different, like the surfaces are different, but the thing I always go back to is you had to have a gravel bike. Like a gravel bike was the fastest bike on that course.
And I like wasn't super pumped on the slicks, you know? Like they were good, but I almost wished I had a little more tire up front. So I think that means it was a gravel race. You know, if you're racing on 38 or 40 mil tires, it's a gravel race.
100%.
Yeah. Like I wouldn't have, there's no way in hell I'd touch that course when 32s, you know? Yeah. So I think that means I did a good enough job making it technical enough.
Well, and the other thing is I know you went in thinking you might run a 52 tooth chainring. Then we pre-rode and you were on a 50. And then come race day, you went down to a 48. I was
kept
like,
going
damn.
Down. I know. Cause after pre-riding that last loop, I was like, man, like I don't want to have to be in the 52 all the way up these climbs. Cause it just eats watts. Like,
for sure.
You're just, it's so inefficient. Yeah. So, and there's like, there's nowhere out there where you're really ripping along. Like I think I spun out the 48.10 once, but it wasn't like even really spun out. You know, you could have ran a 46 and still been in the race.
100%.
But at that point, you know, you're just ego. Like I can't race a 46.
All right, man. Thanks for doing it.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Let's jump into some Q&A time here to wrap things up. We got, almost 70 questions on the Instagram IG. Thank you for that. Of course, there are a good number of duplicates. So we kind of aggregated a handful of the most popular, and we'll rip through as many as we can here in a reasonable amount of time. First question. What was the team plan before the race and how did you adapt that during the race? So we had a team meeting, 2 days before race day. And Keegan was a little sheepish to say it in the meeting, understandably. He's a modest guy, despite tearing hearts out on a weekly basis. He can be a little bit more soft-spoken. Alexi, on the other hand, I think is a bit of a natural-born leader and piped up and said, look, Keegan can win this race on a good day. We should all ride for him. And we're all on board. And those of us that decided we wanted to attend this Gravel Worlds wanted to attend in large part to have that team experience because we believe so much in Keegan's ability and wanted to see if we could help him be successful. As it turned out, there was a bit of a plot twist once we got there, which was our start positions, which has been talked about plenty at this point. Keegan and Luke Lamperti had the least bad start position, although they were still back, I think, in the 70s and 80s. That said, when things kind of compressed there on the start line, instead of, you know, 30 rows of 8 people across, it kind of becomes more like 23, 24 rows of 10 or 12 people across. And so they were able to sneak forward a little bit. And then also Luke is so good at navigating hectic fast drop bar bunches like this. He was able to help Keegan kind of navigate that opening start loop. And then of course, Keegan has plenty of World Cup racing heritage, which this start certainly resembled. And so together, the two of them were actually able to get to the front of the race before the start loop even finished, which is just 3 kilometers in. And there's actually a great photo of them sitting about fourth and fifth wheel as they finish the start loop and go back through the start line, because the start loop was basically a start circuit. So all that to say, those two guys did a great job getting to the front, and Luke pretty much was the only guy all day who was able to really help Keegan. I say all this to say we had our team meeting, but we weren't really sure how much planning was really valuable, because we had a feeling our start position was just going to make it so that at least a good portion of us never even factored into the front of the race, never even would get up there to be able to help Keegan. And unfortunately, that's exactly what unfolded. Again, for anyone that saw some of the videos I posted, you could see just how ridiculously hectic it was. It was hands down the most insane first hour of a bike race I've ever been in. Like, nothing comes close. And I've raced World Cups, you know, Unbound had a year where it was an absolutely ridiculous start. Nothing compares. Alexi did an awesome job of getting up to the front briefly into the lead group. And then kind of ironically, it sounds like Keegan started pushing the pace on the front after they exchanged a couple of words and Alexi got blown off that front group again. But I mean, if we'd all been able to get to the front of the race, the idea would have been cover some moves, keep Keegan out of the wind. But our main concern was, can we help Keegan get to the front and conserve energy doing so? And Luke was the one that was able to do that, thankfully. I think moving forward, if more of us are able to be at the front of a race like this, we will be riding for Keegan again. Absolutely. That's very much solidified after his ride at Worlds. It'll depend on the course. You know, this raced a lot like a marathon mountain bike race. It was just full gas, and just sort of a race of attrition. Like there were virtually no tactics. There was never a breakaway. There were never any, you know, flyers. What would have been incredible is if someone had been up there when Keegan had crashed, to help him get back up to the front rather than chasing the 20 minutes flat out solo that he had to. Even with great start position, I don't know if any of us would have had the legs to do that. Even Alexi, who I think was probably, you know, the second strongest on the day. But we learned a lot. We will see next time. I'm sure it'll be a point of discussion for the next 360 days before the next Worlds. But if nothing else, it was a hugely valuable fact-finding mission. Most memorable moment. I mean, there were so many, honestly, so many memorable moments. One sort of theme that comes to mind was just the fans. You know, you watch the tour on TV, watch Grand Tours on TV, and it's always it's a constant reminder of just how big a sport, how much of a mainstream sport it is over in Europe. But I kind of forgot that it's like, to an extent, across the board, you know, no matter if it's a World Cup, no matter if it's the tour, no matter if it is the first ever Gravel World Championships, Europe shows up to bike races. And there's just this enthusiasm and this cultural deep rootedness that we just don't get in the States ever. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but a lot of it is just bike racing in Europe has been going on for a very, very long time, and it's a much more mainstream sport. And so it was so cool to be a part of that. I mean, I had goosebumps at times during the race. You literally go through these tight corridors of fans on really steep climbs, and you know, you can taste the beer on their breaths, and you know, cigarette smoke and cigar smoke and chainsaws revving and cowbells going. It was just electric, and the fact that it was like that off and on for a 104-mile course really says a lot. So that was hugely memorable. Another thing I won't forget, not as great a memory, but sort of when my race ended to an extent in regards to my own competitiveness, which was, I don't know, hour and a half in. And after chasing across splits constantly for the first hour and a half of the race, I ended up on the wrong side of a split again, but this time on a longer, loose, slippery gravel descent. And so the gap that opened was a lot bigger. And this was purely because of bike handling ability discrepancy. And this is something that Zach Calton mentioned in his opening soundbite. It was really surprising how broad the bike handling abilities were in this race. Just about everybody was really strong. Like the depth of fitness was pretty incredible, but there was a lot of disparity bike handling wise. And so when I got caught behind a couple of other riders, it was bad news. It was 10 plus second gap. And after that section, when I was able to get around them, it was a flat
fast section of road, some 90 degree corners. It was actually through the finish circuit area. So this course basically was a kind of hard to explain, but there was a long point to point section out to a village where the finish line was. And then we did two big like bow tie circuits. And so we actually went through the finish line three times. And this was the first time going through the finish line. And the group ahead, I knew I had to get to if I wanted to stay competitive in this race. The group behind me was kind of dismantling, and the riders were not of a fitness level where we were really going to come back to that group. And so I knew I had to do it on my own. I was already in the red, but it was sort of like, as my coach would say, yes or yes. There was no decision. Like, I just had to try. So I went across this gap, and as I was starting to close to it, I could see just how strung out the group was in front of me, which means they were going fast. And I got a glimpse of the front, and it was Johnny Vermeersch driving the front. He had, you know, the number one plate on his bike from being defending world champion. He's one of the most established world tour guys there is, classic specialist. And I just knew in that moment that it was really bad news for me to close that gap. After already being in the red, I had to be going faster than he was going. And even though there was a lot of adrenaline going in the moment that sort of like masked the pain and the effort, I had a feeling it was super bad news and just like a really debilitating effort for me. And that ended up being the case. I made it to the group, but we immediately went into the longest climb of the day right after that. And I just absolutely blew to the moon. And it took quite a while to come back from that. So just another lesson really in how crucial positioning is in these races, especially over in Europe, especially when a field is as deep as the one at World Champs. And yeah, I mean, it's by no means an excuse. It was didn't have the legs and didn't have the position, and I just needed to be better if I wanted to contend further towards the front of that race that day. But I'll never forget, my point is, I'll never forget looking ahead and just seeing, oh shit, that's defending world champion that I'm going head to head with right now, basically. Did you find the world tour riders had more support on the ground? Example, Swanyers. Hard to say, because, you know, we were kind of doing our own thing. We had great support from USA Cycling. I was able to get a massage every day. So, you know, great logistics getting to and from pre-riding. So hard to say, hard to compare in that regard. Was Wout as fast as you guys fixing his bike on the fly? And did you meet Mohorič? Didn't meet Mohorič. Would love to meet Mohorič. Wout took a wheel change from what I could see. So I assume his mechanic was pretty quick at that. But it seemed like these guys were just kind of riding their rim or riding on an insert when they punctured and just getting to the next pit predominantly, because there were a lot of aid stations and pits out there, which is something that's different than US gravel racing, of course. How did the World Tour pros treat the US gravel riders? Fine. I mean, there wasn't any like glaring disrespect one way or the other. And the other thing is, you know, a lot of us are friendly with a handful of the guys in the World Tour. Someone like Alexi, for example, was in the World Tour, so he knows many of the World Tour riders personally still. I don't know. I mean, I kind of had my fun little moment with Valverde where he looked over at me and like very intentionally seemed to be talking to me and was like, this race is crazy. So I think there was, I don't know if all the World Tour guys really know who the US guys are per se. Like, and this plays into a future question. Like, our scene is very small in the US and insular as compared to what's going on in Europe. Like, and being there was such a reminder of that. You know, it's a mainstream sport. These are superstars in their countries. I was at a restaurant one evening and there was a newspaper out and it was, you know, front page sports news was just a Lombardia predictions and a deep dive on the contenders and their strengths and weaknesses and all that sort of thing. And you could see it too, you know, when we were rolling around town and the bigger name World Tour riders started showing up in the days beforehand, you know, Demi Vollering would roll through by the start finish area, and just so many cameras would come out. So I think it would be a little presumptuous to like compare ourselves to that scene. What we have with the Grand Prix is awesome and it's on a steep trajectory, but they're very much two different worlds at this point. And it was fun to drop into this other world that's, you know, very much more, even though it was the second ever Gravel World Championships, it felt, you know, like a world tour race in some ways, with, you know, big team buses and all that sort of thing. So, I think there's a little bit of curiosity maybe from some of the World Tour pros about what's going on, but in terms of like how they treated us, quote unquote, I think a lot of them probably didn't know who most of us were, and some were indifferent, and then some maybe do follow it and were friendly. So, yeah, hope that answers your question. How often were you asked about the Grand Prix? So this kind of plays into it too. Virtually none. I think maybe twice. And that's kind of what I was meaning. Like it's really two worlds. Like the guys and girls that are competing in the Spring Classics are doing Grand Tours and full time in the World Tour. Like they're not really paying attention to the Grand Prix very much. I think a few of them, it seems like, are, you know, I've had conversations over Instagram and such with a few World Tour guys who are curious about the scene, but by and large, you know, they're very much two different leagues, and European World Tour is like dwarfs the Grand Prix, obviously. How was it the same and how was it different from a gravel race in the US with a large pro field? It was very different. I think the thing that comes to mind right off the bat is just the depth of strength and fitness. So in the US, even at a race like Unbound, we might have 25, 30 guys who are quote unquote front runners, and you can kind of position your, if you want to be in the top five going into a technical section or key point, fighting your way into the top five is hard, but fighting your way to be 20th really isn't too bad. The difference with Worlds, fighting into the top 100 was just an absolute war. You know, there were 100 plus guys that were really good instead of 20 guys that were really good. So you just had to fight for every position. Everyone is just confident too, I noticed. You know, no one was intimidated. Everyone was willing to dive a corner, lean on you, stick an elbow out, exchange some words, whatever it was. It was just a hugely deep competitive field as compared to even our most competitive US races. What was your most rewarding moment of the race other than the finish? You know, it didn't happen often, but there were a couple points in that first hour and a half where I would link up with another US rider. You know, it happened a couple times with Alexi, happened once with Zach. And just that feeling of a teammate in this absolute sea of chaos was just this little bit of, I don't want to say tranquility, but like, just put you at ease a little bit, made you feel that little bit of added comfort, added motivation, just a kindred spirit in, you know, a otherwise chaotic environment. And just seeing another US jersey, you know, you would want to like go over in that direction and just link up with them, exchange a quick word, check in on them. How are you doing? Do you need a bottle? Do you need food? You know, do you want to try to move up right now? Exchange a pull or two. That was really cool. And I would love to have that feeling again, especially in a race that, you know, we kind of have our ducks in a row a little bit more for. I think that would be really cool. Do you foresee brand sponsors and athletes getting behind forming a gravel team similar to road cycling? Not anytime soon. I mean, the cost of that would just be monumental. And also here in the States, you know, the races are so attritional that oftentimes teammates aren't going to be hugely helpful, or at least not nearly as helpful as they would be in road racing. We saw a few examples this past year where it did make a big difference. For example, when Russell flatted an unbound and Howard gave him his wheel. But to field like even a 5 or 6 person team of all riders that can be at the front doing something would just be, would require way more budget, than there is, for US racing at this point. You know, you're talking multiple millions of dollars, to do that, to have, you know, a 6-7 person team all working together. Because you also have to pay riders well enough to convince them basically to kind of be domestiques of sorts, which is a big ask for, you know, the U.S. scene at this point. So I don't see that happening anytime soon. Who knows how the race will grow, or sorry, the scene will grow. Worlds did feel like a little bit of an inflection point in some ways, just in terms of the growth curve of this thing. I think it's really globalizing right now. Like, it started to globalize over the last couple of years. But the success of this Worlds, it just felt like there was so much more press around it, so much more media. Obviously, the fields were way bigger. I think this will steepen the curve internationally, and who knows what that means economically for the sport over there and here in the States as well. But not anytime soon, I don't think. Well, we see, you know, big multi-person teams like we do on the road. How did you find Treviso and the surroundings? Any culturally shocking things? Not necessarily culturally shocking. I love being in Europe. You know, I really love visiting Europe. It is such a world apart from the States, even despite a decent number of people speaking English in Italy even. But it's just, I love traveling, you know, whether it's for bike racing, whether it's Europe or somewhere even more culturally removed than the United States. I feel like traveling is just so healthy if you have the means and the privilege to do it. It just really, I think, broadens your understanding of the world, of course, and also people, and just, you know, gives you tools to be a better person in your own circles as well. So every time I travel, I learn things that I take back home with me, and I can't think of anything specifically off the top of my head right now from Italy, but it was an absolute pleasure as always, and I really look forward to going back at some point. Do you think Keegan would have won if he had started at the front? Really hard to say. I mean, he got to the front really quickly. A far bigger issue than his start position was the crash he had. But playing, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda is a slippery slope and probably kind of unrealistic. I mean, obviously he was one of the top 5 strongest guys there and didn't have a perfect day. So I think he probably could have done better than 5th had it been a perfect day. How much better though is impossible to say, but I think he certainly plans to go back and find out. To improve starting positions, should the UCI account for US events, or should US riders just plan to race a UCI Gravel Series event? I thought, of course, there was some frustration about our start position, but putting myself in the UCI's shoes, you know, how are they supposed to quantify a high placing at Unbound or a good finish at Steamboat Gravel, you know, whatever it is? Like, there is no point system there. Like, how do you assign a points-based value to 4th at Steamboat or 3rd at Unbound or whatever it is? So I get why they omitted those results. It was frustrating, but I get it. Definitely the solution is for the US riders that want to compete at Gravel Worlds in the future is to do Gravel Series events. Absolutely. And I got a peek at next year's schedule, and there are a lot of them. I'll certainly plan on attending a few. Obviously the Grand Prix is going to be busy as ever next year, so it's not like we can go out and hit 6 or 7 of these things, but I think if you just hit 2, you know, 3 or even 2, and get some results, it'll go a really long way to improving start position. If Keegan didn't stack it, could he have made it to the selection of three. I think it's quite possible. That's what he was telling me. And also, you know, crashing and then having to chase solo for 20 minutes is not nothing. So yeah, the crash was a huge deal for him, unfortunately, but that's how that happens. That's racing, especially a race like this that was so dynamic, so twisty, and honestly deceptively technical. What are the rules on cutting corners? Pretty much, if it's not taped, it's free game, believe it or not. This is how a World Cup mountain bike racing is. Obviously, that's way easier to tape everything. But in Europe, it's just kind of free game. And you see that in road racing some, but often oftentimes the cameras don't capture it. But in a lot of those spring classics, you know, they're just hopping all kinds of road furniture, taking all kinds of creative lines. And that's where, you know, you hear often about the road captains in the spring classics, you know, having all this experience and knowing exactly how to position, where they can, you know, use a corner to move up in the group. And a lot of that is just literally knowing curb by curb, you know, signpost by signpost, where things are, where you can hop on a bike path, to get a little advantage. So, you know, by and large, it's just the way it is. Sometimes the UCI will throw out a fine if they decide something is extra egregious, but pretty much if it's not taped, if there isn't some sort of course marking there telling you to not go a place, it's pretty much free game, believe it or not, in Europe. Did this race change your view of American off-road talent at all? Not really, although it was really validating to see Keegan have such a solid ride, and Lauren as well. I mean, fifth and sixth in that field, I'm not as surprised. Well, I'm not surprised by either, but from Lauren, you kind of expect her to be in that area just because she has so much European road racing experience. But I think it was Lachlan that said, you know, finishing fifth like Keegan did with no European drop bar experience is just incredible, because there is a different skill component, you know, navigating a group like that, on those narrow roads. Like, you always hear neo pros talk about that, especially ones that come from the States. Like, there is a learning curve there, and for him to do that, is just really incredible. So I think that was validating and just really cool for all of us. All right, I think that's all, guys. Thank you so much for the questions. Hope you enjoyed that Q&A section. That's all we got for today. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. I really hope you enjoyed that World Champs recap episode. Boy, I forgot to say at the top of the show, but we're just full gas racing still, going into week 6 of 7 weeks in a row of racing. I'm in Bentonville, Arkansas, Little Sugar 100K mountain bike races tomorrow. And then we'll finally wrap the season the weekend after that with the Big Sugar gravel race, the last round of the Grand Prix, which will also be our last recap episode of the year. So you can look forward to that. Before a couple last little notes, I do want to say one more thank you to Zip for supporting today's episode. Their new 1-0 high top SW cross country wheel is just awesome. They're truly making cross country faster. And I've been on this wheel actually since about this time last year. I rode a prototype all the way across Tasmania. It was awesome. Perfect wheel for that environment, but it's also the perfect wheel for racing really fast. A lot of times these days, I feel like wheel brands get sucked into this arms race of just getting lighter and stiffer, and those things are important. This 1-0 high top is light, it is stiff, but it has this vertical compliance, this ride quality that just really makes it feel alive, and that goes a long way to just efficiency over rough terrain, and then also fatigue resistance, just being a little easier on your body. They also come with really awesome hubs, the ZM2 SL hubs with 66 points of engagement. This wheel also comes in a little bit more affordable option, the 1-0 High Top S. You can go find out more about both options at SRAM.com. I also want to say a big thank you to Salt Stick and their awesome fast shoes. Like I said earlier, the fast shoes would have been awesome at Gravel Worlds. Things were so hectic, as you may have noticed from some of the videos I posted on Instagram. There's also a 7-minute version of the start of Gravel Worlds up on my YouTube as well. But fast shoes are great when you just want to get electrolytes into your system efficiently and quickly. Electrolytes can be absorbed in mouth tissue up to 4 times faster than, you know, drinking it in a more traditional sense. They're kind of like sweet tarts, these things. They come in great flavors, lemon, lime, mixed berry, tropical mango. A big fan. They come in 60-count bottles, 10-count Ziploc packets as well for easy jersey pocket use. You can find them at REI, Amazon, or at saltstick.com. If you go to saltstick.com, by the way, you can get 20% off with code PAYSON20. Go check out Saltstick at saltstick.com. That's all I got for you today, guys. What's next? Episode next. We'll probably do a long-form interview next week. I know there's been a lot of recap episodes recently. Let us know what you think of that. If you like these recaps, let us know. If they're kind of wearing on you and you just want more, you know, long-form sit-down interviews, heart-to-hearts with individuals, let us know that too. I like any and all. These are certainly more work, though. So big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing each and every one of these shows, especially these ones that have lots of parts. As always, you can go to The Adventure Stash on Instagram to get clips from the various video clips, that is, from the various podcast episodes, as well as play our weekly quizzes for a chance to win a pair of Stash House Productions socks. All right, thank you all so much for listening today, and we will catch you next week.